Hello and welcome to the seventh night of Millennial 2019. I have three guests tonight. In 2 hours from now, it will be Frode Medjord from Scanza Forum, and after that, it will be Red Ice to see us through into Christmas Day. But first, it's Keith Woods. So Keith Woods, I'm sure most of you will be familiar with him already, but he has a YouTube channel. He started earlier this year. And he's quickly made, obviously, a name for himself as a heavyweight in the movement, a thinker, a very deep thinker. And so I'll just let you introduce yourself, Keith. Welcome to Millennial.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I don't know. I'm not very good at introductions, but I mean, everyone subscribe to my channel and you can get introduced.
Yeah,
I'll just plug it as many times as possible.
It's linked in the description so people can find it there very easily. So tell us about when did you start your channel exactly? I think I first became aware of you probably the second quarter of this year, I would think. So when did you start and why did you start? And yeah, just tell us that story.
I actually started it on the first day of this year, January 1st, 2019. Yeah, I've been considering it for a few months. I've kind of been in the distant right since probably around the time of the Trump election, which was obviously a formative moment for a lot of people. And it is kind of, you know, the typical story here with the YouTube algorithm slowly swinging the pendulum and you're slowly discovering more truths, which is funny because actually, a final anecdote, I fell asleep listening to Millennial a couple of nights ago. I can't remember what night it was, but I fell asleep anyway watching it on my phone, and I woke up in the morning and YouTube was playing me an interview with a libertarian economist from some neoliberal think tank. So that's the YouTube algorithm now. You start with Millennial Woes and you end up with neoliberalism.
I remember when somebody was talking about the alternative influencer network, and he said it's true, it does lead you from one figure to another. I started off with Murdoch, and then ended up at Millennial Woes, and then found Jordan Peterson, and now I'm at Sargon.
Yeah, it's funny actually. I was talking to one of my friends during the night, who's a bit of a normie. He's a bit like you know, he's into like Ben Shapiro, Jordan Peterson stuff, and he was like, "Oh yeah, you know, YouTube really leads you down that dark path. Like it brought me to Jordan Peterson." I was like, whoa. Fuck.
Fuck.
You know, not realizing that is the gatekeeper.
Yeah, yeah. Does your friend know about your channel?
No.
Well, you got to be prepared for this. I mean, he might well find it. you're only skipping a jump from Jordan Peterson, Keith.
Well, it was last night. It was two guys I haven't seen since school. So when I went to school with them, I was like, you know, they knew me as a lefty Sinn Féiner. So I used to like try and spoon feed it to people and like slowly win them around, but I just sat down and just started arguing for National Socialist principles with them, and but they ended up agreeing with me. It's fine. I think you do hone your skills if you have a radical viewpoint and you get used to having to be on the defensive from people calling you all sorts of names. It forces you to be a good debater. So I mean, by after a half hour, I kind of did have them become an ethno-nationalist without much difficulty. So it's one of the benefits of being so ostracized, having opinions like that.
Well, so you said you were a lefty as a teenager. That's something I hadn't even thought to ask you. Tell us about your political evolution.
Well, I always had sort of an emotional connection to nationalism. I suppose that's probably more common for Irish people. You know, nationalism was kind of the default here. And then when I first got sort of interested in politics was maybe like the 2011 election, 2010, around that time. I was maybe like 16 around the time I got interested in it. And I gravitated to Sinn Féin because Sinn Féin were seen as the nationalist party, you know, with their associations with the IRA and everything else. And it's also that thing of, you know, you're watching your country being plundered by neoliberal capitalism. And so in reaction to that, you go to socialism, which you think necessarily is associated with all the wacky socialist ideas about open borders and global homo. So that just seemed like a natural thing to do. So I was a Sinn Féiner for a while. And then I started reading philosophy, read Nietzsche, and I had somehow I had this warped interpretation of Nietzsche where I became like a leftist anarchist, like the Max Stirner type. And
how old were you at that point?
17.
Right.
Yeah, so it's like it's getting into like anarchism, anarcho-syndicalism, George Orwell, that kind of thing. I think I even had like an anarchist blog for a while, which is kind of embarrassing to think about now. But yeah, and then the more I thought about it, again, just following a progression, I got kind of alienated with that as well. And part of it was the heavy sort of focus they have on the social stuff that didn't seem to me to fit the economics of it at all. And so for a while then I was kind of drifting, drifted out of politics, was much more interested in philosophy. I kind of felt alienated from politics, didn't like the left, didn't like the right. And then in university, I guess I started looking into ideas more deeply from a philosophical perspective, in that I kind of went back to political theory from a more philosophical point of view. And so I was able to discover thinkers like Joseph de Maistre, J.G. Hammond, these like anti-Enlightenment figures that were really interested to me. I've always been drawn to sort of iconoclast thinkers. So that's like the most iconoclast thing, is to be a post the Enlightenment, it seems, in a university setting. So started studying some of those, and then, you know, discovered the radical traditionalists, people like Genon, Shuon, and then Evola. And I guess once I got to Evola, that was kind of the big awakening. And this also coincided with a lot of things. It coincided with the Trump election, where at the same time I was sort of seeking out content on YouTube that'd fit with stuff I was studying myself. And so it ended up, of course, drawing me to alt-right figures, unless this seemed to be, because Evola seems quite abstract in that you can read Evola and accept his principles, but it's hard to see how they could manifest in the real world. In that,
okay, I was going to say, how did you reconcile Evola with Trump?
Well, I wouldn't say I was ever like a massive Trump fan or anything, maybe for a while, but I think the way I reconciled actually was probably Savitri Devi. Savitri Devi's idea that, because I'm quite interested in like the Eastern spiritual traditions as well, and she sort of married those three things, like Hinduism, National Socialism, and like radical traditionalist ideas of someone like Evola, and her idea of fascism or nationalism being, you know, the like instantiation of some sort of like Platonic conception of natural law, or, you know, dharma, logos, whatever, that there's a lot of people in that movement often talked about the natural order and the laws of nature, but that basically, you know, Savitri Devi's idea that these political ideas were the manifestation of that eternal principle in sort of the Kali Yuga, the Dark Age, that was like the best you could do. So that was like a kind of a real world description of Evola's sort of abstract principles. But again, that stuff I probably didn't get into thinking deeply about for a while. I mean, the alt-right was just, I think the reason I was drawn to the alt-right, to be honest, regardless of any of that, was because it was the only movement that was in any ways idealistic. Because,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because after reading Nietzsche, it seemed to me like what made me so alienated from politics was that I remember thinking this and like describing it to friends, but they didn't really get it, that the left and the right were both motivated by materialism and everything. Even the left, when they talk about helping the working class or socialist policies or whatever, the end goal of those policies is still to enrich people, and they're still talking about, you know, GDP growth or whatever to pay for those policies. So it seemed to me that they were totally lacking. Any concept that could be, in any ways, a basis for transcendence or for something beyond yourself. There was no higher ideal. So, you've seen figures in the alt-right then that were taking these sort of high philosophical ideas, even if I didn't agree with some of them. Just the fact that they were trying to bring this existential aspect into politics seemed to me to be the key. And then because of that, that's what made me interested in the ideas. And then out of that, of course, you're engaging with the other arguments about, you know, biology and race, realism and stuff. But I wouldn't have been interested in them or looked into them if it wasn't for that initial spark of finding a movement with this. You know, Heidegger said that people could never understand why Heidegger supported and joined the National Socialist Party in the 30s. And someone interviewed him and asked him why. And he said it was because they were the only movement since the Greeks that had a tragic conception of life. Which I thought was a really interesting answer.
Well, and then, of course, I was going to say, do you feel that the SJWs, the progressives, the left today are idealistic? Because they probably would say so. But, of course, they don't have a tragic conception of life. Do you think that's part and parcel?
Yeah. No, I don't think they're idealistic. I mean, they're idealistic insofar as their ideal is the destruction of ideals. I mean, their operative principle, you know, their endpoint that they're aiming for is a complete destruction of meaning. It's the, you know, they want humans to be the tabula rasa of John Locke. They want us to be born without identity. They want people to be identityless creatures that purchase their identity or that find their identity in these malleable social groups like LGBT movements or whatever. And they want to destroy all, you know, what is really the basis for beauty in the world, which is the natural inequality that exists between peoples and within nature. And they want to destroy the, you know, things like traditions, things like religion, things like connection with a community through ethnic bonds. They want to destroy all of these things because they precede the individual. And that seems to me a really nihilistic conception of life.
See, I often wonder if we're caricaturing the left, because I agree with everything that you just said. And I think for me, the ultimate proof is that they want to destroy even the most fundamental thing, which is the distinction of male and female. They want to destroy even that. So they want nothing. If that's gone, then surely everything else is gone as well. And it's just a complete free for all. It's just chaos, just atoms. That's how I see the left. And I think how you see the left as well. But I wonder if they would say, no, we do have ideals and we do believe in categories. But, you know, it just, I'm not asking you to think for or speak for them. I'm just sort of noting the frustration that they don't speak to us. You know, I wish I could have a, you know, calm conversation with a leftist, but they just don't speak. I can't help but think that in itself is very, very telling. You know, I was talking to, well, several of my previous guests about ContraPoints and, you know, figures like that. And the fact that they talk about us, but they don't talk to us. It's amazing. You could almost think, well, you could easily think that they simply know that they would lose any debate with us. And that's why they refuse to have any debate with us. I don't know. Is it right to look at it in those terms of losing and winning debates? But I think at this point it kind of is, because it's the ideals or the notions of our age that are on trial here, that are on trial in any meaningful debate. So that there is something to be won or lost. There is, someone is going to be wrong and someone is going to be right, broadly speaking.
Yeah. Well, you know, it probably isn't fair to say they have no ideals. I mean, I remember when I was a leftist, my ideal was basically a radical individualism, which might seem surprising, but that was the whole time I was a leftist, my starting point was individualism. And when I moved to the right, my starting point was, you know, the greater good outside of the individual, which people conceive of those things as the other way around. But for me, the ideal was to have this anarchist idea of a complete flattening, so that everyone was starting from, you know, the same starting point. Like, you know, Rawls' idea that you have to take this approach to morality and to politics, where you know, you could be born as any person. You know, you have to take this view from nowhere before existing, and you could be born as any person. So the point should be to make the least well off and put them in the best possible position. And I thought that this was like an extension of a principled individualism, and that out of that you could have a greater propensity for human achievement, because you wouldn't have so many people lost to poverty or whatever. So, I mean, that is an ideal, but at the same time, because their ideals are wholly materialistic, there's only so idealistic they can be when they're still operating in that, because it does again come down to hedonism and their conception of the good, and their conception of the good, if you talk to a liberal or a leftist, generally comes down to happiness. And, you know, if it feels good, do it. If it's happy, if it's making them happy, why are you concerned about it? And so that that hedonistic principle, that individual pleasure for the person involved, trumps anything outside of themselves, and anything outside of themselves is then torn down with relativism and nihilism and all these postmodern debating tricks that they use. But I definitely agree with you that, you know, you hear people say that debate is pointless and you can't win anyone over with debate. No one ever gets convinced with debate. But I don't think that's true. I mean, I've changed my opinions on loads of things by listening to debates and just deciding that one side was more convincing. And in a lot of ways, I've learned more through that than reading academic works. There's, you know, there's something in that Socratic method where you can glean real knowledge and wisdom out of that. And
it is very fast. It's very fast motion whittling down of, you know, delusion and pretension and falsehood.
And, you know, no matter how much academic philosophy or science, you know, it comes down to what can be reproduced, because what's the point of it if you can't speak it and engage with someone using it. You know, I know people may complain that people are reading less and it's been replaced by podcasts and YouTube videos, but I don't think that's wholly a bad thing either. But I think we've won the debate. I mean, that's why they're silencing us. That's why the debates have stopped. It's very hard to get a leftist to debate anyone now. I know Destiny is going to be debating Mike Enoch, I think, before the new year. So I'm surprised he's agreed to that. But I mean, the norm definitely is that they won't engage us.
Yeah. I don't know what the situation is with Destiny, but I've heard that he is kind of moving towards us in some ways, but I don't know the details. So we are getting lots of questions. Could I ask you to post them not in the live chat, because they get lost in the live chat and I can't post them on Entropy. To cut a long story short, it's much better if you post them on Entropy. There, you can post free ones there as well as super chats. So please do that. So I had a question for you about, and it's a question I know that you've answered it before, but I'm going to ask you again because it seems like a good opportunity. What the hell is the story with Ireland over the last 20 years? Because it seems that 20, I know you can, if it's not interesting, you can answer it briefly, but I want to know from your perspective, because it seems that Ireland in the as late as the mid 90s, maybe even the early 2000s, was a very traditional European country. Like Britain, like England was 50 years before, almost in some ways, and now it's hardcore progressive. It seems so, at least in some ways, that the progressive juggernaut has really taken hold in Ireland. So, can you give me your perspective on that?
Yeah, it's a few things. I mean, probably the biggest factor was economic, in that we were always a very protectionist country, and Fianna Fáil Party, that's been the dominant party here, you know, in the 1930s, was its leader Eamon de Valera was very admiring of Mussolini and Italian fascism, and he had a program that was very, very protectionist, and de Valera's ideals really kind of shaped Ireland. He was a prime minister for so long and then president, and he was a reactionary, you know, he was a Catholic, he was part of the uprising, but he was perhaps, you know, the most reactionary of any of them. A lot of people think that de Valera was probably autistic, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, he had this vision of a country that would be, that wouldn't glean its wealth from its material wealth, but that, you know, the wealth of Ireland would be that we'd have, be dotted with little cottages with children playing on the streets and, you know, this nice religious traditional vision of Ireland. But, you know, in the 1970s, the Fianna Fáil Party began to adopt a neoliberal economic policy that was, and Fine Gael, I mean, you can't just blame Fianna Fáil, but basically all parties here started to embrace this neoliberal model where the basis of our growth would be attracting American multinational corporations to set up shop here. So, you know, that was done by our entry to the EU, which gave them access to the European market. It was done by investment in free education here, which gave them an educated workforce to use. And the most important factor was done by a massive cut in corporation tax to be lowest in Europe, down to 12.5%.
Is this why some famous corporations have their headquarters, or at least their European headquarters, in around Dublin?
Yeah, it is. So we have 12.5% corporation tax. That's the lowest in Europe. But actually, the big corporations don't even pay that. They use all sorts of loopholes so that some of them pay less than 1% or 2%. And this was exposed where the EU actually decided that Apple had underpaid us something like 16 billion euros in tax and forced them to pay it. And the Irish government are rejecting this and are taking the EU to court to try and stop Apple paying us 16 billion. So,
I mean, that's remarkable.
Yeah, and both of the establishment parties are in complete support of that because, this would be damaging to our reputation. We don't want to be accused of doing sweet tax deals with corporations. And it's like we have homelessness. We have a homelessness problem. 10,000 homeless people in Ireland. We have a healthcare problem, and you're going to turn away 16 billion because of reputation. It's absurd, but. Yeah, so, you know, Apple is here. Facebook have their headquarters here. PayPal, all of the big
YouTube.
Yeah, all of the big corporations have set up shop here, and that brings with it. I think people are starting to realize, especially the last few years, is that you can't have economic liberalism without social liberalism. The idea that you can have international capitalists running your economy and be completely reliant on them, and that they're not going to, that your country isn't going to end up reflecting their values, to me is absurd. I mean, when there was the abortion and gay marriage referendums here, the leaders of these companies were very open in their desire for how they wanted these elections to go. And Facebook quite openly interfered with the abortion referendum and that they didn't let targeted ads from pro-life campaigns be shown. So I think the big aspect of it was economic, because we have no industry here now. We used to have industries that were part-run by the state, which was, again, a legacy of the sort of third positionist Fianna Fáil government of the 30s. We had things like Bord na Mona, which was like Irish peat, you know, fuel, and we'd sugar industry and these things. That's all gone now. So we're in a situation where we can complain about the politicians all we want, but they're not really dictating policies, because if those corporations left tomorrow, we'd be left with absolutely nothing. You know, apart from the corporations, we have a service industry. We have shops and cafes and that kind of thing, which are in turn reliant on demand brought in from the foreign capital of the MNCs. And we have a large public sector, you know, nurses, policemen, all the rest of it. And again, that's paid for with taxes brought from the MNC. So we're just a complete vassal state. The other thing, I suppose, is even despite that, we probably wouldn't have embraced these values so quickly, only for sort of underlying problems that was there in the logic of our culture. I mean, as you said, we were extremely conservative, but that was, I think, actually against us, because we had this sort of unquestioned Catholicism. You know, there's a return to Catholicism in a lot of different places. Like Poland seems to be kind of embracing its Catholic heritage, and that's kind of a conscious Catholicism. But we had this sort of fire and brimstone Catholicism, where you just did what the priest said, and there was this real subservience to authority that I think was maybe a leftover of the British Empire, where the Irish have this strange slave morality where we're always looking for a standard to judge ourselves from the outside. So for a long time, it was the British Empire and trying to be more British than the British. And there's, you know, the early nationalist revolutionaries were held in contempt by the ordinary people of Dublin, where they fought, because most of those people had family fighting in World War One for the British Empire, and most people were actually against independence. And when we did gain independence, many of the idealists that started that revolution, the real hardcore nationalists that had an idealistic conception of what Ireland could be, most of them were killed in the Civil War or the War of Independence. And so we were left with reactionaries like people like De Valera and Cosgrave that led the first government. And they basically, I mean, to a large extent, most of the infrastructure of how we were run by the British Empire was kept in place. The education system, the public service, civil service, all that kind of thing was kept in place. And on the social side of things, we just sort of, I mean, the schools were handed over to the Catholic Church. And it was, you know, De Valera was very closely allied with the bishops. And it was this, again, this sort of unquestioned outside moral standard. And because it was very much a devotional Catholicism rather than a conscious Catholicism, that's more open to being subverted. And the same thing probably applies for nationalism, in that there's two kinds of people in the distant right. Just go off on a tangent here. There's the people that came to it through a kind of intellectual journey or whatever, and that are genuine dissidents and have genuinely sort of integrated these perspectives into their entire worldview, into their being. And then there are people that are unquestioned sort of nationalists that are, you get this especially in Ireland, that there, a lot of the nationalists are just racist, you know. And I'm sure I'll get some flack for that, and white people, you know, calling white people racist, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, it's true, because like, there's nothing wrong with that, and yeah, your movement's always going to be made up of people like that. But I think it's good in a way to have been on the other side, because it's like you're inoculated against that disease. Because people that are just sort of this unquestioned, people that hold a belief in an unquestioned way, more out of prejudice, tend to, even if they'll stick to those beliefs, it's very easy for the system to force them to adopt other subversive beliefs with them, and they're easily drawn to the, you know, my taxes, my liberty stuff. So there's a tendency sometimes to confuse pre-rational ways of looking at the world with sort of trans-rational ways of looking at the world, and that's the way they'll tear nationalists as well, is they'll throw us in with the people that are in a sort of pre-rational state. But the thing about the mode of being that liberalism engenders is that it's wholly rational, in that it doesn't recognize trans-rational truths beyond that narrow instrumental reason. I just realized this is a massive tangent from talking about what happened to Ireland, but
No, it didn't go on that long, and it was about three minutes maybe. I do like what you just said about that there are some people in nationalism who are just racist. I mean, I think it is true that, and it's the kind of people that I tend to avoid, because I find them lowbrow and boring, and I just think they're basically bad for the movement, because the fact is, I don't want my people to be replaced, but I don't want to invest, and I don't want to spend any time, hating on other people's. So it's just a fact. I really don't have any time for it. It's pointless. And
they also abandon the moral argument, because, again, this is a thing I hear a lot from Irish nationalists, where they're like, they'll take a position like, you know, some leftist or liberal appeal to universal morality, and they'll say, I don't give a damn about this thing. All I care about is my family and my people, my country. Or they'll say something like, it's the individual first and then the family, and then the country is just an extension of that. And it's this kind of individualist nationalism. And unfortunately, like, you're surrendering the moral argument, even though you could win it. You know, you're saying like, I'm not going to engage in these moral discussions. I'm going to reject any conception of morality, and we should all just be out for ourselves. And, you know, while there's something to that, and we probably, white people in general probably need to think more like that, you shouldn't surrender the moral argument to the leftists and just give it to them, because we do have a moral case to make that is like universally valid. So, you know, I just think you're playing into your hands if you talk in those terms.
Yeah. Can you give people an example of speaking in those terms so that everyone knows exactly what we're talking about?
Well, like, you see right-wingers being extremely reactionary on environmental questions.
Oh, and, yes, yes.
Like, that's an example. It'd be like, you know, we'd pollute the rivers to own the libs kind of thing. And, but even more generally, like, if a talking point in the news is something about some global crisis or the effects of environmental destruction or whatever, you'll get people that just say, well, I don't give a damn about that. All I care about is my family and my country, and hell with the world.
Another one would be animal rights. About a week ago, I saw you on Twitter battling valiantly on the matter of the wolf culling in I think it was in America. I didn't actually know the basis of it. I didn't look into it, but it was people going on about wolf culling, and I think it's in a particular way where they get the omega wolf from the pack and whatever. It doesn't matter. Animal rights. I mean, surely any decent part. It just seems to be a function of, you know, decency that you would care about the suffering of animals, but of course. A lot of right-wingers will say, oh, no, that's lefty territory. If you talk like that, you're either becoming a leftist or you're surrendering ground to the left, which I would see it rather as, no, we're taking ground from the left.
Yeah, I really do think it's a shame the relationship between nationalist movements and environmentalism. Ecology is probably a better word to use than environmentalism. Ecology was actually, as a term, was actually invented by a national socialist theorist in the 30s. And the two things are very connected. I mean, as nationalists, we're trying to preserve the natural ecological diversity of nature. We, you know, there's no rational argument from a naturalist perspective for why it's bad that the Siberian snow leopard goes extinct, is there? I mean, if there's 20 of them left, they're not having any great ecological impact in terms of keeping other species in balance, or whatever. If there's, you know, if there's 20, 30 of them left, but at the same time, I think we all recognise something, a deep tragedy if the last snow leopards were to be hunted out of existence. And leftists will recognize this for animals, but then they'll have no problem with the disappearance of an ethnic group, especially if those ethnic groups are European.
I think that's a glaring, glaring contradiction in their worldview, and indeed in the centrist worldview as well. I mean, you know, you see this kind of stuff. I'm sure that Sargon and his type would think, yeah, it's a shame that species has gone extinct, but you can't get them to somehow, when it comes to human beings, it's all about values. It's just, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and that's another reason why the ecological perspective fits well with the right, because the left have an unnatural view of the world. They think that that values exist in this abstract Cartesian way where minds sort of inhabit bodies, and that they aren't caused by biology. Whereas, from an ecological perspective, a sort of radically immanent perspective, values are an aspect of nature, and they are a reflection of biology. And in terms of the preservation of ecological diversity, I mean, if you're to make the moral argument for nationalism, and you're to boil it down to first principles and really try and make a moral case, it seems to me that it's inevitable that you'll have to fall back on a kind of ecological argument. So to try and again argue from this sort of individualist, nihilist perspective of, I don't give a damn about any of that. I just want my people to prosper, and I don't have to engage in any of this, I think is very short-sighted. But that's just reflective of a more general tendency in the right, which is to be completely reactionary and to define itself in terms of just opposing whatever the left is doing. And the problem with that is, I mean, maybe it's a good starting point if you want to try and figure out your position on something. But the problem with that is it means you're going to lose, because it's a positive vision going up against a vision that only defines itself by the stopping or the slowing down of that positive vision. And so even if you win a few battles, they're just roadblocks, and eventually they're going to get what they want. So, environmentalism, if you're going to impose environmentalism by saying, we don't care about the environment, or, you know, people say, oh, I do care about the environment. Oh, I do actually, I'm just opposed to all of the proposals the left have about the environment. Well, it's like, well, where's your vision? Because
Are your proposals? Exactly. There are two options for the right winger in this position that they take. There's a third option they should take, but the two options they generally take is either the left are simply wasting everyone's time with this concern, and they're wrong, and I have no interest in it whatsoever, or it's, yeah, whatever, it's not my problem, and I'll give in to the left. So either way, the left win. But the third one is, okay, I understand the importance of this issue. I disagree or agree, whatever, with the left's proposals for dealing with this issue. And here's my perspective on it. Here are my proposals about how to deal with it. If you don't do that, if you disengage, you're simply ceding ground to them. Because always you look like the guy who doesn't care about this important issue. And the left is not only getting people interested in it, but getting them interested in proposals for that issue.
And sometimes people think as well that because they identify as nationalists, that to engage with global issues, or to engage with issues from a more global perspective, or talk in terms of global solutions, that's to sort of surrender ground, and they just refuse to engage with this. But I mean, at the end of the day, facts are facts, and we do live in this globalized world now, and the issues of the coming years are going to be things like, whether you like it or not, environmentalism, the effects and the shape of international capitalism and the finance system. And again, to just disengage from that and say, no, I'm a nationalist, we're just going to have our own individual ethnostates and not have globalism, it's like, well, that's fine, but it's not really going to happen in the next few years, is it? And these global issues are actually the stumbling block to you having those nations. So if you say, like, oh, well, I'm not going to get involved in any of this heady stuff, like criticizing international finance. I'm just an Irish nationalist. I just want an Irish nation.
Well, that would be the ultimate. That would be the ultimate self-defeating disengagement.
Yeah, and that's the perfect example of it. It's like, it doesn't matter if you don't want to engage with this stuff. It's engaging with you. And even the extreme petty nationalist perspective, where you get this a lot in Ireland. Oh, why are you engaging with white nationalists? We're not white. We're Irish. Well, it's like, there's four million of us, and we're going up against there's more than 4 million, like 5 million of us, and we're going up against all these outside forces. And at the same time, all of the other countries of Europe and the United States are facing these exact same problems, these exact same structural issues, the same faces, the same enemies, and the enemies operate in a global way. And if we're just going to divide ourselves and refuse to use words that we think are off-putting, like white nationalists, or we refuse to work with other Europeans, we're shooting ourselves in the foot there, definitely.
That's so interesting. I mean, there are several implications there that I think a lot of people might find that they'd rather avoid. And the first is, as you say, a lot of nationalists who don't want to ally with other nationalists in other countries, because, well, we're not German, so therefore why should we have anything to do with German, the movement that's going on in Germany or Austria or France or Sweden? But the enemy doesn't care whether we're Swedish or German or Irish or whatever. They're attacking us because we're European and white European. So that's one thing. But the other thing, as you say, is the issue of petty nationalism. And, I don't want to, because that sounds almost synonymous with Little Englander, which is a token of contempt that the left use to discuss, people like us. Well, obviously, you're not a little Englander, and neither am I. I'm a little Scotlander, perhaps. But anyway, the point is, Richard Spencer once said, he said something like, it's not a matter of ethno-nationalism. It was never going to be a matter of nationalism. It's a matter of globalism, and the question is not globalism or nationalism. It's which type of globalism. That's the future that we have to pan out, because globalism is not going to go away. Now, there is a very interesting and important distinction between globalism and globalization. Globalism is a mentality. Globalization is a fact, a process, and so on. The globalism is an ideology. But nonetheless, if we disregard that distinction for now, would you agree that it's? And I don't know what I think about this. I'm pretty sure that Spencer was correct about this, that it's not going to go away, so therefore we have to harness it for our own ends. But give me your perspective on this. Is the future going to be a choice of some or other type of globalism?
Yeah, maybe a choice of Rome or Jerusalem, but I don't want to rain on people's parades, but like, you see how excited people get, like, oh, Hungary elected, LeBased prime minister, or oh, Poland just brought in anti-LGBT laws, and like, this just seems insignificant to me, because I don't think the globalists really care. Like, yeah, oh, Hungary has a nationalist government now. Well, you know, how long is that going to last? You know, they've shown they can subvert a nation like Ireland in one generation. And when there is this, you know, Hungary still has to operate in this globalized world. And how long can this last when they start filling the television screens with propaganda? When the NGOs start funding public relations campaigns? When the children there are being exposed to pornography at a younger and younger age? When they're on an international capitalist financial system, and they have these global oligarchs interfering in their economy? It just seems to me it's just wishful thinking, you know, that we don't have to engage with globalism, and we can elect a base prime minister and close the borders and take back Western civilization. But
I like your phrase, LeBased prime minister. I do like that. But I mean, I understand and I agree with you. That might annoy some of my fans, but I think it's simply true. You are right. You're observing that globalism in some way is too powerful to be fought, at least directly. Now, that doesn't mean that we should surrender to it. It doesn't mean that we should give in, but I think we should be looking to engage with it, and we should be looking to build a power base so that we can engage with it in a persuasive manner.
And if you want to see an example of what we're talking about, like, I mean, just imagine what the US or what Europe would be like if the US didn't exist. Like, the amount of propaganda that's come directly out of the US, the amount of NGOs influencing policy in Europe, the amount of think tanks, you know, Chicago School Economics, people like Milton Friedman, who is really the new Karl Marx of the day. All of these things out of America, economic neoliberalism and Americanization, really, this cultural Americanism of neoliberalism and Zionism. And even, you know, the discourse here is so heavily Americanized, where you have parties in Ireland talking about liberty and low taxes and all this stuff, and it's like, you know, these are foreign ideas. And I think if it wasn't for the Americanism, I think Europe would probably easily fall back into a natural state of nationalism and tradition. So again, this is another thing you see people saying, well, screw the Amerimuts. The Amerimuts, they're all, you know, the burghers, leave them to their fate. They're not European anyway. We should just focus on Europe. It's like, well, you know, that's fine, but guess what? If they lose in America, and if the oligarchs get complete control of America, not that they don't already have it, but if things get worse in America, try stopping them getting worse here. Because, I mean, you even saw it with the Trump election. The Trump election, there was so many of these national populist parties and movements popping up around Europe. So it's just wishful thinking. You can't just say we're not going to have anything to do with the fate of the United States. We're just going to decide Europe's fate. We're just going to decide, I'm a Hungarian, I'll decide Hungary's fate.
on the matter of wishful thinking, I think that is quite common on in our milieu, that people think that they can just decree that the world should be like this. And it's like, well, it's not like this. So, and your proposal for getting it to that state is completely unrealistic. You're basically just wanting to tell everyone to be like this from now on. It's not going to work like that. It's quite annoying. It's quite frustrating. You know, there were, we were talking last night, I had a woman on called Annika, and there were lots of guys saying, well, women should do this and men should do this. But okay, yeah, of course, yeah, they should. In an ideal world, they would be, but they're not. So what? It's not enough to just say, declare that's how the world should be. You know, we have to be less naive, less childlike than that, more constructive than that.
Yeah, another reflection of it as well is that people want to construct a kind of dissident movement where they don't have to be dissidents. And that they're not willing to sacrifice anything, and the idea of people sacrificing something for a political movement has been absurd. And you know, they lambast the cringe Whignats or whatever. But again, the idea that you can have these ideas and that the system is going to let you away with it, and that you can just vote your way into power and change the opinion of the main political party. We'll just turn the political parties against immigration and win. Again, there's so many deeper issues at play there. It seems to me, you know, it's just trying to have this mass appeal that we can get more people into our movement by telling them that they don't have to sacrifice anything. They don't have to dedicate themselves to this. They don't have to identify with labels they're uncomfortable with. You know, they can just keep their old lifestyle and hold these ideas as a side thing. I don't know if that's a great approach, because do you want people like that? I mean, what changes the world? What changes history? Is it getting an idea that's popular and slightly shifting the public position of some larger group, or is it dedicated groups of dissidents? I think looking at the historical record would probably say it's the latter.
Yeah, I'd say so. And I mean, I read different percentages on this, but apparently it's you don't even have to get that great a percentage of the public on your side. It's something like 10 or 15% in order to trigger a sort of cascade effect throughout the whole culture. That's something for another time, but I definitely agree with you. Indeed, we are up against a paradigm here. It's nothing short of that. We're up against, I mean, that's it in abstract terms. In concrete terms, we're up against corporations, governments, oligarchs, billionaires. So, yeah, it's not going to be easy. But let's not blackpill people, because I think it is possible. We just have to be intelligent about this and forthright, and there has to be solidarity.
Well, in a way, there is a white pill in that as well. And, you know, talking about small movements changing history, I mean, before the Russian Revolution was a few Marxist theorists sitting around a pub in London discussing these mad ideas about dialectical materialism and the course of history, and I'm sure people thought they were absolutely stark raving mad at the time. But it's, you know, people get into this thing of we're not gonna win, so I'm gonna drop out. But there isn't a way to calculate like a percentage on this. I mean, we have a greater than zero chance of winning, and it seems to me that it's a waste of time. Look at trying to predict the next 40 years. I mean, there's so many variables, there's so many unknown factors. There's always Nassim Taleb, a mathematician, talks about these black swan events in history where they're completely unforeseen and they completely change the course of history, something like World War One. And, you know, looking back in hindsight, we rationalize them as being inevitable, and the history books show that there was an inevitable course of events following from various factors. But that belies the sudden sort of catastrophic nature of them. I mean, no one in the 1980s was predicting that the Soviet Union was going to collapse within a few years and the Berlin Wall was going to come down. So I don't see the point really in engaging in these. It seems kind of cowardly and kind of feminine to try and calculate a percentage and like a calculate a chance of winning. And if the chance is too low, to just give up. I mean, there's nothing noble in that.
Yeah, I certainly agree. Okay, we'll move on to, and we've got good view. Someone just pointed out we've got good numbers. Just now we've got 1,100 people watching on Christmas Eve. So that's, you're a popular guy, Keith.
If that, chat, press one if you're happy I'm here.
All right, we'll move on to questions and super chats, which should be posted on Entropy because they get lost in the live chat. So please don't post them there. I will not see them. okay. Has Keith watched or read any of Varg, Thulean Perspective, Varg Vikernes?
Yeah, I used to watch him a bit before he got taken off YouTube, yeah. Yeah, I haven't really followed him since. Yeah, I mean, he's got an interesting perspective, yeah.
Someone says that you attract tons of Vari Vikernes fans for some reason. I wonder if it annoys you, he says.
Well, that's actually news to me. I didn't know that, but no, that definitely wouldn't bother me.
Okay. All right. Why don't we start a government petition to have white people classified as a protected species?
I don't like the idea of that. It just sounds it sounds kind of, I don't know, not defeatist, but just again like going to. It's like this thing of like going to the Republican Party, being like, "Hey, will you please have a stricter stance on immigration?" Like, you know, this thing of taking this approach of pleading. I mean, even if the argument is right, I think we should be much more forceful in that. It should be much more forceful language. We have a right to exist, and this is our land.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they're not. See, when I read that question, my immediate answer was because it wouldn't work.
Petitions, okay.
Okay. All right. A question for Keith: is there a part of Ireland that is the most nationalist and/or traditionalist?
Well, probably. Well, Donegal is like the most northern county, and they're known for like voting no to every government referendum, like abortion, all those things. I guess it's quite rural, a strong Republican tradition there because it's so far north. So, I'd say maybe Donegal. Obviously, the Irish-speaking regions as well, a lot more traditional.
Do you speak Irish, by the way?
No, which is a great shame because I did, like most Irish people, learned it the whole way through school, but we most people leave without very much Irish at all.
Oh, that's a shame.
I had an Irish teacher that used to, I later found out it was a quote from a poem that he said English took over in Ireland because it was a better language to sell pigs in.
All right. Okay, another one. Nisha said, a sedentary life is the real sin against the Holy Spirit. Only those thoughts that come by walking have any value. Was he correct? I say not, but I'm disabled. So, unfortunate for Papa Lazarou.
I don't know. I mean, I definitely get some. I definitely find my thoughts flow a lot better when I'm walking. But maybe there's something to that. I don't know.
Okay, is there a lot of immigration to Keith's part of the world right now? That comes from me in it. And yeah, there is. That's what we've been talking about for the last 50 minutes, for God's sake. But yeah, Keith, you can answer that. Is there a lot of immigration to Keith's part of the world just now? Keith?
Yes.
Thanks. All right. Estonia has the most successful ethno-nationalist party in the EU, while being the least Christian. For most EU youth, any form of Christianity is unappealing, while ethnic tradition is cool. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like Prague and Austria are quite, you know, they were two countries that were really pushing back on the migrant crisis. And Prague is, sorry, what am I saying? Prague, Czechia Czech Republic and on Austria. And Czechia is the most atheistic country in Europe, and Austria is quite atheistic as well. So, it's definitely possible to have this kind of, you find these kind of secular sort of liberal nationalist parties popping up in these countries where it's it often gets turned into weird kind of Zionist ideas, like we have to keep the Muslims out to protect Jews and homosexuals. But I think just as a broader point, I don't think it's helpful to constantly frame moral arguments from existing religious traditions. I think the secular case for them can and should be made, and oftentimes is a more forceful argument in a lot of ways.
The same person also said, the based Sevenat Catholic Poland opens its doors to thousands of cheap labour from non-Muslim countries like the Philippines. Maybe Christianity, Catholicism, is inherently Sevenat, and we should resurrect ethnic traditions. Or ethnic tradition, he actually says.
Well, this is the eternal debate in the alt-right, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, there's perhaps something to that. I mean, I've heard Christians use the Tower of Babel story as being something that that justifies nationalism, but it seems to me that the opposite is the case. That natural ecological diversity is among nations is a punishment or a sort of accident of history, and that the natural state is this more universal way of being. You do find, getting back to the ecological thing, like Savitri Devi was very, very anti-Christian because she said that the Abrahamic faiths were the first anthropocentric religions ever devised, the first religions that put humans and the human soul above nature. And she traced a lot of problems back to that. And I think liberalism, the Enlightenment, was really a secularizing of Christianity, and a lot of the principles that were at the foundation of the Enlightenment, this linear view of history, a positive view of human nature, Cartesianism, the separation of the mind from the body that led to the sort of tabula rasa conception of Locke, and then individual rights, you know, coming from, again, very secularizing of Christian ideas about the, you know, the worthiness of the individual and the individual soul as having sort of an independent existence outside of nature. A lot of these things trace back to the Christian tradition. And it has to be said that the Christianity of old hasn't been conducive to a lot of these things, which isn't maybe to say it couldn't be. I mean, I don't want to strongly counter-signal Christianity, but in a lot of ways, modern progressivism is secular, is the secular Christian ideal. It's this sort of a hyper real extrapolation of the ideal of Christian universal love into this this secular universalism and progressivism. So unfortunately, I kind of do think the two things are connected.
Yeah, I think they probably are in some way, at least in a superficial way, they are. I think they have to be connected just because, that was our... Oh, we've got some audio interference there. Yeah, just because that was... We've swiftly gone from a very Christian culture to a very secular culture, and this thing seems to have survived. So,
which again isn't to say that Christians can't oppose it, and we of course probably I'd say maybe most of our ranks are Christian Catholic, so at the same time more conscious Christians Catholics can be opposed to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out, because people often say that Christianity is just a religion that was devised in order to cuck Europeans and make them open to mass immigration. But the mass immigration only started with 1,500 years after Christianity. So it's a very slow working poison if it took 1,500 years to work.
Yeah, the opposite end of the spectrum, people that say Christianity is a wholly Jewish religion. I mean, I think Christianity is more Greek philosophy and pagan tradition than the Hebrew element, much more, especially in Catholicism. That's why I'd much prefer a return to Catholicism than some kind of Protestantism, because Protestantism seems to me the Christianity stripped of, first it's stripped of the Aristotelianism, so it's stripped of the Greek aspect, and then it's stripped of the aesthetic traditionalist elements, the pagan elements, and once you strip those things of it, you're kind of left with Judaism. So I'm pissing a lot of people off, but I'd much rather a return to Catholicism than any other form of Christianity.
Right, okay. There are many questions, so I'll try to get through them as quickly as possible. Can you see any stable future for Ireland without getting back to its strong Catholic roots once more?
Yeah, I can, yeah. Again, I go back to this pre-trans fallacy is what a philosopher called Ken Wilber calls it, which is a fallacy that since I've heard about this, it's something I increasingly notice in all kinds of discussions, which is where people conflate a pre-rational way of seeing the world with a trans-rational way of seeing the world. And it happens on both sides, in that people that that have sort of pre-rational beliefs or rational beliefs can't conceive of a trans-rational belief. So perhaps a Christian can't conceive of someone having a comprehensive morality, or you know, so a country like Ireland being saved without a pre-rational, ready-made belief system. What I think you see with the, you know, what you see with maybe the distant right as an example is that people can go from pre-rational ways of interpreting the world to very rationalist ways of interacting with the world based on instrumental reason that are fundamentally nihilistic, and that they can actually, you know, they can transcend that, and they can come to a sort of a trans-rational perspective where goods beyond instrumental reason are recognized, and it's subjugated to that. Again, probably sounding very abstract, but that's the way I see the course of history going. To quote T.S. Eliot, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive at where we started and know the place for the first time. I think that's the way the progress of history works, is that we fall away from these truths, and through this middle process of rationalism and individualism, we can actually come back to these greater truths in a more self-conscious way.
The prodigal son sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Oh, somebody asked quite a lightweight question. I'll put it up on screen for you so you can just read it yourself.
No.
Okay. All right.
Whenever there's super chats on my show, there's always one like, "Can you ask him to sing an Irish ballad?" It's like, no.
All right. Okay then. Does Keith think that a new Irish monarchy would be a good idea for the native population? Of course, a new Irish monarchy.
No, not really something I've ever considered.
Okay. Why did they vote for a gay half Indian?
Well, actually, they didn't, because he wasn't, you know, he was elected in his own constituency, but he was chosen as the leader of the, we're talking about Leo Varadkar, Prime Minister of Ireland. He was chosen as basically the Taoiseach of the time. The Prime Minister resigned, and then he was chosen internally by the party. But that's not an excuse either, because at the same time, that party is probably more popular now than it was then. So they would choose a half gay Indian. So, you know, he's the Google Prime Minister. You know, Google filled their call centers or whatever with the Indian IT people, the tech people, and now that's how they're going to run the countries as well. They're going to have they're going to have tech people from India that that don't have families that can spend all their time on the administration of these vassal states for international capital.
Oh, fucking hell. All right. When did the left give up on economics and embrace being purely about social deviance?
I think it was the 1960s. Slavoj Žižek has written on this. It's quite interesting. So, you know, if what we talk about cultural Marxism, the Frankfurt School, people like Marcuse, Adorno, who were actually, I actually have a bit of time for them. One Dimensional Man is a good work. It's a good critique of modernity. If reactionary should read it. But you know, their idea is that their idea was that you could take the traditional proletariat was disappearing basically, and so there had to be a new source of how you'd find a mass movement to oppose capitalism. And their conception was that you'd get radical movements of the times like the Black Panthers, the radical environmentalist movement, radical feminists, and that you'd create this sort of coalition of the dispossessed to attack the system with. This sort of culminated in the protests of 1968. There was, you know, this big uprising of youth in the 60s, especially in places like France. And I think a popular slogan at the time in the Paris riots was "Marx, Mao, Marcuse." That was the foundation of their beliefs. At the same time, this was kind of being married to sort of a post-structuralist, post-modern ideas like ones coming from Foucault that were very heavily individualistic and sort of a normalizing of deviancy and a challenging of our traditional moralities that define people in these ways. But what actually happened, what came out of all this wasn't the downfall of capitalism, but it made capitalism more robust in a sense, in that the capitalists basically adopted the ethic of the radicals. So the radical leftists went after the school, the family, the factory, which were the sort of three pillars of Fordist industrial capitalism. And what you had was, you know, the family is replaced by more malleable social arrangements, whether that's, you know, gay marriage, whatever. The factory was replaced with this more sort of postmodern, egalitarian, democratic means of organizing workers and production, where it's all team-based and people work together as teams and offices, and it's all about individual performance and actualized employees and all this nonsense. And the school is obviously heavily propagandized now into the deviance of the kind Foucault advocated. So what actually happened was the radical so-called cultural Marxist ideas just became adopted by the capitalists as the sort of the superstructure of what they were trying to do. And so, you know, to call a cultural Marxist in a sense is, I think, sometimes misleading, because this is cultural capitalism now. And while it was theorized and formulated by explicitly Marxist thinkers like Adorno, it found its fit as the social arrangement for oligarchs, and it's benefited those oligarchs immensely.
And the perfect demonstration of that is modern Ireland. I mean, the corporations arrive in very shortly after.
Mm.
You've got this situation. So, all right.
Yeah, I mean, the way to conceive it is these things don't happen in isolation. And I mean, it's funny, this is kind of a Marxist critique. You know, Marx's idea was that the superstructure of ideology is determined by economic relations, and that if you want to know why people believe something, look at what's the economic explanation for this. How does it benefit the ruling elite for people to believe this? And just as the nuclear family was the superstructure of Fordist sort of industrial capitalism, the superstructure of post-Fordist, post-modern international capitalism is woke progressivism, because this kind of capitalism needs open borders. It needs people to be malleable, you know, change careers multiple times, be upskilled, whatever. It needs cheap labor. It needs people advocating open borders. It needs a breakdown in traditional family orientation. So I more and more see all this as just a reflection of the needs of capital and of the ruling elite. which is what the left wing should be saying, but they're too focused on drag queen story or and J.K. Rowling saying that sex is real.
Yeah. Is a globalist superstructure necessary for environmental preservation? Because we were talking earlier about that kind of stuff.
No, I don't think so. I mean, again, I think a more ecological way of living would be this more sort of rooted, authentic racial nationalism that is a much more natural ecological way to live. I mean, there may be something in that a huge amount of pollution now is coming from the third world and from Asia. And I guess there is a question, like, if countries are engaging in acts like that, whose burden is it to step in and to tell them to stop? I mean, at the minute, it's these international organizations like the UN, but the question of population has been completely abandoned. Environmentalists used to be very concerned about overpopulation in the 70s and 80s, but that's been completely abandoned now. But I think
not completely abandoned. I mean, you hear about the billboards in London a few months ago.
There's going to be a billion extra Africans by 2050. Nigeria's population is going to double. There's going to be there's actually no population growth forecast for the next 30 years from Europe, South America, North America, or most of Asia. It's pretty much all Africa and India, and so I mean. Again, this idea we'll just become nationalists and focus on our own country. Actually, I want national leaders that are willing to say we actually don't want this massive population growth in Africa. It's completely unsustainable, and I think there's probably an easy solution to it, which is to stop propping them up with Western means of sustaining that unnatural population, which aren't natural to that continent.
The population of Africa has absolutely skyrocketed in because of Western aid, and it is, as you say, a completely unnatural situation. I read I think it was Nigeria, but I can't remember which African country. I just saw this last night. Basically, its population is going to double in the second half of this century, and it's doubling now from in this half of the century. So I think it was 750 million people in this one country alone by the end of the century. 750 million. It's absolutely staggering. I think the population of Africa as a whole is four and a half billion, something like that, they're projecting by the end of this century. This is, I mean, I don't want to go into this for obvious reasons, but it's going to be a massive logistical and moral and social problem that needs to be solved because there simply aren't the resources to deal with this, let alone the government infrastructure anywhere in the world to deal with these numbers of people. It's absolutely catastrophic.
Yeah, it is scary. I mean, I know I think by 2050, Nigeria is going to pass out the United States. I think Lagos, Nigeria is forecast to eventually become the most populous city in the world. And yeah, it just keeps going. And I mean, even someone as cooked as Macron said that the problem with African population is African people are having too many children. And he was absolutely lambasted for that. But
he also said that the futures of Africa and Europe will be greatly closely intertwined. So he's envisioning that they're all going to, well, not all of them, obviously, but a lot of them are going to come up to Europe.
Yeah, I mean, 4.5 billion, that's clearly an unnatural number, and it's clearly only sustainable by this international system. But how long can it last? I mean, if there is a big global collapse, what's going to happen to those 4.5 billion? You know, is it going to be mass starvation? I mean, is this a moral position from the leftists that we're abandoning future peoples to this fate? And what's going to happen in terms of them fleeing that continent to trying to make it to Europe or even the Middle East? I mean, it just sounds like a disaster of absolutely epic proportions in the making. But unfortunately, you always see this whenever there's a contradiction between woke progressivism and humanitarianism. Woke progressivism wins, you know, like something like halal slaughter, where liberals that are supposedly so concerned about animal welfare will just be silent on this. Yeah, so it just shows you what really has the sway here.
Yeah, indeed. And a question has just come up a statement. Why do I, and it's interesting, reminiscent of what you were saying earlier about petty nationalism, why do I have to figure out fixing Africa as well as Ireland, as well as religion? I just want my country back. That's, I've got to say, is I don't want to be unsympathetic, but it's as if you've tried to write exactly the kind of thing that Keith was referring to earlier.
Yeah, no, I don't want to fix Africa. Like, this thing as well, like, someone said to me, I was making fun of this the other day on Twitter, and the first reply was someone was like, so I guess we should just accept refugees for climate justice and give all our money to Greta Thunberg. And it's just like, no, I don't want to fix Africa. I want nothing to do with Africa. I want to leave them to be and let the chips fall where they may. But in terms of why should we care about any other country? I mean, I think I've gone over that. I mean, I think if you think that American culture, if you think that Americanism isn't one of the number one causes for why we are where we are, then you're just, I'm sorry, but you're just deluded. I mean, you know, there's a good article in UNS and the Occidental Observer, I don't know, was it today or yesterday, by Andrew Joyce. Vulture capitalism is Jewish capitalism. And he was talking about these vulture funds that are completely run by an ethnic minority in the US. And they buy up sovereign debt at a fraction of what it's worth when a country is in big trouble financially. An example was Argentina, where one of these funds bought Argentinian junk bonds for $47 million. And then they use legal wrangling to force the country to buy back those bonds at full value. So Argentina paid $1.4 billion for $47 million bonds. And this has actually impacted Ireland, because these international vulture funds bought up huge amounts of Irish property after the financial crash and started kicking people out of their homes. You know, it just underlies the fact that there are these parasites in charge of the economic system, and they operate globally. And the same people that are kicking people out of their homes in Ireland, if you look into it, these same people are using the profits of this to siphon off money into American Friends of Israel and AIPAC and all these like Paul Singer, who Tucker Carlson recently profiled. He's one of these vulture capitalists. He's made $3 billion through these completely unethical practices, and he's one of the foremost people that pushed gay marriage in the United States. He said that his goal in politics is to make the Republican Party become a pro-gay marriage party. I just think it's naive and it's ignorant to try and divorce yourself from any of this. I mean, I don't care if you don't care about it. It cares about you, and it's affecting you, and it's causing these problems. You can say, you can ignore it all you want. That just means that you're going to have terrible answers and terrible, uninteresting solutions that are divorced from reality.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's like the person who says, I don't care about race. Well, race cares about you. I don't care about Islam. Well, Islam cares about you. I don't care about multicultural. Well, it cares about you. In the sense that it's going to come and affect your life. Hmm. All right. So we'll get onto the super chats. Happy Christmas to both of you brave lads. A stocking full of white pills for all. So thank you very much, Rachel. That's very kind. Is our movement a vanguard for the next left? E.g., how egalitarian, compassionate, and ecological is it to treat... Oh, dear. Torin, I'm sorry, but I can't read the rest of that super chat. Sorry. But... do you think there's any what he said there, is our movement a vanguard for the next left?
Well, I mean, I would like to, if we, it'd be a great win if we could influence the left in some way. I mean, like, as I say, a lot of these critiques about, you know, global homo, right? That's a term that's been used a lot in the distant right this year. I don't know where it originated. But global homo, like this idea that woke capitalism is another example, and global homo, this idea that there's this global culture that's a reflection of these international oligarchs, and it basically exists to propound consumerism and bugman culture, another great term, the bugman. But all of these terms, these are Marxist critiques of political economy. And this is a sort of Marxist structural critique of modern culture as just being a reflection of this this drive by international oligarchs to drive consumption and to destroy anything that's a barrier to that. And that's the critique the left should be taking up. It doesn't seem to me. I mean, I can't find an honest leftist that's willing to say that anti-racism and modern forms of feminism and LGBT are just in the service of the oligarchs. But if they're going to engage in structural critique, that's what they should be doing. And also in terms of the racial element, I mean, you know, Karl Marx wrote a work called On the Jewish Question. It's an interesting read, very scathing. And the idea that that Marx or Engels or any other honest Marxist would not critique a group, would not look at something structurally and say that the elite of this society is composed of this group, and because that's, you know, that's a structural rational honest analysis. The idea that they wouldn't engage in that, and that they'd let some liberal principle of anti-racism or progressivism trump that, is absurd. So no, this is like, this is 100% what the left should be doing. I'm not saying like I'm a leftist that just believes in racial stuff. Like there's a more inegalitarian aspect to being paired to the dissident right, but definitely the real left should be with us on far more of these issues. And the fact that they aren't just shows how controlled they are by international high finance.
Mm, indeed. It's often transparent. I mean, but yeah, I don't need to go into that. You've said it. Do you think, and this is an Irish friend of mine, she's posted quite a few questions for you. Do you think Catholicism is an artificial distortion of true Irish nature?
Again, that's a deep question. I can't say I've hugely engaged with the paganism versus Christian thing, because I often find that the only thing this does is divide people in the movement and make them argue over nonsense. So I don't think it's relevant. You know, I guess you'd have to discover what the Irish nature is outside of Catholicism or global homo, because, you know, I know you talked about this in one of your last videos, that, you know, we can fool ourselves that we have such a close connection and understanding to our ancestors a few hundred years ago, but do we really? I mean, it seems to me you hit on something there, and
that was the bit that I was most worried about in that video, that in terms of triggering a backlash. But I think most people were sympathetic. I think they understood that it is actually a real point.
Yeah, I think you know, we should be looking to the future of what we could be with certain ideals. Those ideals have to come from something greater than ourselves, rather than looking to return to some idyllic point in the past where we were just the right level of nationalistic or spiritual or something. I think we just have to push on forward towards what we set as our ideals.
Okay. She's also asked several questions similar. I think this is a very interesting question. So I've left it quite late on, but how is Irish character distinct from English character?
Hmm. That's an interesting one. I mean, that was, you know, one thing I mentioned earlier is that we tend to, and this is, I think, a major weakness of the Irish, is we tend to, there's a certain lack of self-confidence there where we have to appeal to the outsider. And so Irish culture now is having the crack, you know, and it's being a good fun paddy and entertaining the foreigners. Answering super chats by saying Irish phrases and singing ballads, and when they go abroad, like they have to be the most entertaining people. And it's funny when you watch the TV shows here, talk shows, and they have a big guest on from the US, a big actor or something, and the level of how much they can be a sycophant is unbelievable, and always trying to get outside approval. And now because we're in the system of global homo, the approval has to come from the people pushing that. So we have to be the best pupils in the room, and we have to do neoliberalism and global homo better than anyone else. So maybe the English have more self confidence in asserting themselves like that. Whereas we've been independent for a relatively short time. I think we tend to look for something to define ourselves against. But that's something I've noticed. There's a difference in the humor. Actually, I quite prefer Irish humor to English humor. Irish humor can be very dry, very dark. It's often multiple layers of irony that foreigners don't seem to understand. I'm quite appreciative of that. That's something that I think would be a great shame to lose when we become another brown economic zone of Europe.
Yeah, to be precise, she asked not about culture, but Irish character. The Irish character, how does it differ from the English character, the psyche?
I'd probably have to think about that. I can't say I've ever really thought about that question. Maybe you can answer it.
Oh, I can't answer it because I'm not Irish and I'm not English either for that matter. But well, then again, I am a quarter English and half Scottish. You know, there you go. That's why I can't answer it, even for the Scots. Maybe it'd be presumptuous of me to answer that for the Scots.
According to my genetic test, I'm 18% English. So,
all right, you can 80% answer it.
Yeah, but I don't know what aspects of my character are the 82 and what are the 18. So, probably just best to leave it.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. It's something that I don't think it's so deep that I wouldn't want to improvise an answer.
Well, you see, the reason I find it difficult to answer is because it's hard to know which is culture and which is those people. I mean, how do you neatly separate those things where you say this is because of history and this is because of the economic conditions, blah, blah, and this is who they are? It just seems extremely difficult to separate those two things.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Someone says that Woz is basically African. That's not true, and it's not fair for saying that.
We're all African, man.
That's true. I forgot. It is a very interesting question. It's the kind of thing that really appeals to me, but that question from Etienne, but I wouldn't want to try to answer it on a live stream because it's just too deep. Same with the Scottish one. She also asked what commonalities can Woz and Keith identify between Scotland and Ireland? And I think, again, it's a deep one, but there are superficial aspects that we could remark upon, such as it is I think Scotland sees itself as the little brother of England and tries to punch up, tries to overcompensate, be more progressive than thou, and so on. I think in the present era, a disturbing degree of Scottish identity, not carrot, not psyche, but identity, which is more shallow, a disturbing degree of it is based on just being anti-English. And I'm sure it's the same in Ireland.
Yeah, and you see that reflected in the political parties as well, because the Scottish National Party is just like Sinn Féin in that they're these left-wing internationalist national parties that just define themselves by opposition to British imperialism and at the same time embrace global homo and open borders. So, yeah, that's a reflection of that as well, which is quite interesting.
Yes, indeed. Okay, can Keith reiterate his views on democratic socialism?
Democratic socialism? Well, I mean, in terms of democratic socialism, I guess if you're talking about like the Corbyn, Bernie Sanders types, it only serves to prop up the system in that it doesn't it doesn't really address structural issues. It makes the inequities of the present system more palatable to people by regulating capitalism. Capitalism can survive and propagate itself. In a certain sense, the two things need to go together, and there needs to be an element of state intervention to support those two things. But democratic socialism is certainly today, at least, is not the answer.
Mm. It does seem to be something that we're heading towards the end of. I mean, if I would say social democracy, I would say it's ending, you know, one way or another. It's the current paradigm, but it's like the EU. It seems to just walk around carrying its own death warrant. You know, it's so obvious that it's just like it's a marked man sort of thing. You know, has Keith ever read Angela's Ashes?
No.
Right. Okay. It's a nice, easy question there. How will, not so much of an easy question now, how will Europe deal with an American empire controlled by non-white elites in the near future, Hispanics and so on?
I'm not sure I see that happening, to be honest. I don't think.
Neither do I. Yeah.
I don't think the elites in the United States that are inviting these people in plan on handing over their wealth and the reins of power to these people. That's not how I think they see it at all. So I think the non-white migration is just going to benefit those same elites, and so it'll be a propagation and an expansion of the logic of what we see currently. I think the United States is going to end up in a situation where you see this in the cities, where you have somewhere like America has been deindustrialized, much like Britain, and wealth is massively focused in places like Manhattan, New York, or Silicon Valley. And within that, you see there's areas of Manhattan with private security forces with virtually no crime, and that's where the elite live. And in the same country, of course, there's this massive wealth, there's an opioid crisis, and there's these people in the middle that are completely left behind, and then there's these slums in the same cities. And I think if you want to see the future of what the oligarchs want, I think look at New York, this brown identityless place where if you're, say, an international capitalist from a highly ethnocentric tribe, you can come into this individualist concrete jungle, and you can easily make your way to the top through financial manipulation and whatnot. And then there's this mass of multiracial workforce that's there to do your bidding. And I think the idea that used to be popular, maybe not as popular now, that the elites want Europe to turn into Saudi Arabia, and they want it to be Europeistan, I don't think that's accurate at all. I mean, I know obviously there's huge problems with Islamic immigration, but I actually think the elite don't want that. They don't want Muslims to be committing terrorist attacks. They don't want there to be this strong ethnic separation. They want global homo. They want, you know, they want the migrants to be pot smoking bug men that play video games and work a minimum wage job for them. And the vision of the future you should be fighting against is New York, rather than fighting against an imagined vision of Europe being Tehran and then trying to
Arabia.
Yeah, and then trying to oppose that with that very Americanized vision, which is actually what they're propagating.
That's interesting, because I think a lot of people would say that that's not what they're propagating in Europe, because demographically we are bound to, well, for Arabia.
Yeah, but I think their vision of that is still one that operates on secular global homo principles. So, you know, at the minute, while they're at war with whites, I think it's because whites have power. It's this high low versus the middle alliance where whites aren't the elite, but they're still the majority. So, you know, this small elite is going to use sort of bio-Leninism and bring in these masses to have sort of a kind of proletariat to overthrow them with. But the end goal, while instrumentally they may go to war with whiteness or whatever, the end goal is this Arabia, but it's not one where there's Sharia law or anything. They still want consumer woke capitalism. I think they do actually want the Muslims to integrate.
Well, ironically, Sargon once said to me, I asked him about, you know, what are we going to do about would you want a Sharia law Europe? And he said, no, but it doesn't matter because Western culture will cuck Islam. Mm. So he's not worried about Islam in the long term. But as you're pointing out, well, that's actually even worse for us in a sense, because it means that everyone, we're just going to be in this utterly identityless swamp.
Yeah, you see, this is the thing. I mean, people talk about immigration is okay if they integrate. I don't want them to integrate. Like, that's, I think that's a worse vision. I think it's worse if they integrate. I think it's preferable to have, you know, Muslim no-go zones and have people completely separated from each other. It seems easier to get a solution of that than to have people, I mean, integration, what does that mean except someone coming and surrendering their native identity and surrendering their native traditions to become infinitely malleable grey subjects under the boot of international oligarchs to be moulded however they want? Why would you want that?
Yeah, I completely agree. Okay, yo, my man Woes, I heard that you interviewed Vertigo Politics last year for Millennial. Will that ever be released? No, because it was a pre-record. I knew that I was going to have to take several nights off last year for Millennial because I had a conference to go to and so on. So I did some pre-recorded, and I pre-recorded one with him, and then he wanted to edit it down a lot. And then he did that and then said that he didn't want it to be published at all. So he just wasn't happy with it. I think he sort of regretted doing something live, even though it wasn't live technically, but it was a conversation. I think he regretted it. I don't think it worked for him. So no, I would certainly not publish it without his permission. And also I wouldn't have him back because frankly, it was a waste of my time. So, I mean, I am a wee bit annoyed about it, as you can tell, but, you know, I do understand sometimes people regret things and, you know, that's the end of it. And, you know, if he approached me and said that he was happy to do it live next year, then yeah, I'd do it, but I'm not going to go through that again. All right, the CCP, I don't know what he means. What's the CCP?
Communist Party?
Oh, right, yeah. We'll soon colonize Australia and New Zealand and annex Western Canada. What effect will the rise of China have on Europe and America, the US?
Well, I guess it's hard to forecast effects, but it certainly does seem like that China are going to come into a position of global dominance. And I think a large part of that is because they haven't been so wedded to free market principles. They run their economy in the interests of the nation state. And whatever you think about the abuses of the Chinese government, that principle that the economy should be run to serve the people rather than the reverse is what's bringing them back to strength. And if you think that they would ever allow, you know, they do have free enterprise in China. There's some hugely wealthy people, but if you think that they'd ever allow vulture funds or people like Paul Singer to come in and engage in these financial practices and buy up debt and kick Chinese people out of their home and then siphon off the money to another country, if you think they'd ever allow that, I mean, not a chance. And, you know, the choice for us now it's not capitalism versus socialism anymore. It's individualism versus some kind of collectivism or some kind of organic state is probably a better way to put it. And we're not going to go back to this thing you always hear, you know, that's not real capitalism and somehow all these corporations have power was just the fault of the government. That's absurd. But the choice now, if you're to be realistic, and a lot of the, I think, elites recognize this, we're not going to go back to this old libertarian form of capitalism where we've open markets and gold-based currency and all this stuff. The choice, basically, is this global homo neoliberalism, individualism, where the international market is the ultimate arbiter and nation states are beholden to the international market, and so they have to compete and they have to undercut each other with corporation taxes, with wages, with all these things to try and gain from being the most malleable to that market, or we're going to run things on the basis of running industry to benefit the state. Obviously, a big problem is that Europe has been so stripped of industry since especially the Thatcher and Reagan years. There was a study published this week which showed the richest and poorest areas in North Europe. Now, Britain had the richest area in North Europe, the area of London, and it also had 9 of the 10 poorest regions. And that's the legacy of Thatcher and of the economics of people like Milton Friedman and Murray Rothbard. Murray Rothbard, whose ideas have been propagated by the Cato Institute, which was set up by these oligarch libertarians, open borders advocates, the Koch brothers. And that's the legacy of it, is that there's been a collapse in the industrial economy, and there's been this move to financialization. And for all the talk about productivity and owning the socialists, well, what happens when you move to that kind of economy? You don't have that native industry that's going to be there, and that your economy isn't based on the productivity of your workers anymore. It's not based on what your workers are producing and what you're capable of producing in a sort of autarkic sense. It's now based on international high finance, and to be at the behest of that is a loss of sovereignty. And for nationalists to advocate policies that would lead to that seems to me totally counterproductive. And I can already see, because every time I say this, someone replies, well, that's not real capitalism. If we have a real open market. Well, you know, if you have a real open market, you know, you have to look at these things structurally, and you have to look in terms of ends. What's the end of going to be of what you do? And the end of having an open market is that, you know, the ideal of having an open market is that you have a sphere of individual liberty or whatever. What happens is you actually have an increasingly large sphere of heteronomy, and the individual gets more and more determined actually by outside forces and by forces of economic necessity.
Right, I thought you were going to speak for a wee bit longer there, so I gave you full screen.
I got thrown off when I was looking at my full screen there, but
no.
But yeah, no, just a general principle. I mean, because it's counterintuitive, because people think pulling back the state gives the individual more liberty, but I think under capitalism it's not the case. It's not the case, because the idea people need to, I think, understand is that corporations, in order to succeed at business, you have to forecast for the future, and you know, you have to forecast that you're going to have a certain supply of workers, that those workers are going to be able to commit to working a multiple of hours a week, and that starts to clash with individual freedom, because the politics of the country you're in and the culture of the country you're in become an externality, just like any other externality to a corporation. And so that's an externality that needs to be controlled. And so, you know, I was in Vietnam a couple of months ago, and there's all these huge, you know, Samsung factories going up, and there's all these American multinationals moving in there. And it's like, you know, they're not going to let Vietnam become a socialist country in the next 20, 30 years. They need certainty in the money they're investing there, and they need certainty in their markets. And it's just a necessity that's going to influence the culture and the politics of the region. So if you want to run something on nationalist principles, you have to have control of your economy, and you can't be letting your politics be dictated as just another externality of multinational corporations. Oswald Mosley talked a lot about that actually a long time ago. He said, you know, he talked about the mistaken conception of freedom people have. He was maybe ahead of his time, and he said the only freedom that counts is economic freedom. You know, freedom to raise a family, to have free time, all of these things. And that gets missed in this false dialectic of individual liberty versus the state.
Well, I mean, basically, you want to be a country with an economy attached to it, not an economy with a country attached to it. I think that is obviously a very simplistic way of putting it, but I think it encapsulates basically the whole thing there. All right, I need you to answer these questions briefly, because I've got another guest on due in 4 minutes. Obviously, it's going to be a bit late, but can you try to be brief with these questions? Obviously, I've got to ask them, because I don't want to let these people down because they've posted them. Why have the Ulster Scots rejected progressivism whilst the Southern Irish have embraced progressivism and even imposed it in Ulster via Sinn Féin?
Well, I think a large part of it is the Ulster Scots defining their identity by this siege mentality. You know, Ian Paisley, never, never, never. And this idea that the Loyalists were always under siege and, you know, Britain or Ireland were always conspiring against them to try and take their land. And out of that came a real strong attachment to their religion. And, you know, the idea of that to sacrifice religion or tradition would be a surrender. And also Ian Paisley started a Presbyterian group. It's quite popular among Loyalists, a lot of sort of young earth creationism, very like Bible-thumping, hardcore Protestant sects, biblical literalism of the kind you'd find in maybe parts of the United States. So that's probably harder to cook as well.
Right, okay. And love your content, Keith Wosey. What are your thoughts and experiences relating to EU immigrants, Poles, Lithuanians, Latvians, who already live in Ireland and Britain? What future awaits them?
Well, I don't have a problem with them. I mean, they do integrate quite well, actually. And the Poles here are, you know, they're good family people, and they're religious. To keep their religious traditions, they're very friendly. They all speak fluent English. You know, they're very very friendly, and you know, do their best to try and integrate and be friendly with the native population. But at the same time, I don't want to you know, open up borders to these, not least because I don't think it doesn't benefit them. You know, Poland having this big brain drain. I mean, people always make this argument about Ireland. Well, you had huge levels of immigration, but I mean, I don't think a brain drain of from a country taking their best and brightest benefits anyone. So, no, I don't think we should. The fact that there's so many of them here as well means that we should definitely start to lower that. But some level of immigration. Obviously, you choose white migrants, but some level of white migration, I think, is acceptable. And you know, the Poles aren't the Poles don't keep me awake at night, I'll put it that way.
Okay, all right. Okay, thank you, Woz for Millennial. There are plenty of channels highlighting what is wrong with our nations. Do we need more channels exploring detailed visions of the nation that we want?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I didn't set up a channel for a long time because I really didn't want to be another person making graphs about immigration or shouting at my camera about, oh, those goddamn liberals, now they're getting to the kids, and you, just this endless complaining and the same old talking points, you know, demographics are destiny, LGBT is brainwashing, like stuff everyone knows. I just thought that the only reason I would ever come on a platform like this is if I felt I had something original to say. So I do think we need to start articulating. It's something we talked about earlier, that if you only have a negative vision, you're always losing ground. So we do need to start articulating more almost utopian visions, giving people something to aspire to.
Yeah. Well, that would be better than just moaning.
Mm.
Even utopian visions are that's a positive. It's something to aspire to and aim for and get romantic about and even have faith in. All right, Keith, do you think it will be an advantage that the dissident right is the political movement with a collectivist approach to the big questions of our time?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, you find this in people that are in it, you know, that they felt a kind of emptiness or a kind of alienation from the modern world, and that there was this sort of spiritual yearning that they found expressed in these circles, you know, kindred spirits. And I think a lot of leftists feel that way as well. And a lot of radical leftists are there because they're looking for something. They're atheistic, but they're looking for something, for some greater ideal that they can commit to, that can give them meaning. And, you know, the more secular and the more materialistic, the more nihilistic our culture becomes, I think people are going to start looking at new avenues for meaning. And I think politics may start to replace religion in a lot of ways for that. So, yeah, we need to, is the answer.
Okay. How optimistic are you about the National Party? And also, how woke do you think the National Party are?
Yeah, I'm quite optimistic. again, I was worried to be another like sort of just liberal national party or whatever. But no, they're genuinely sort of revolutionary in their outlook, and they're not afraid to critique the economic system and to critique the crony capitalism that's at the source of this. And I think Justin Barrett's a good charismatic leader. So I think they're the best we could do at the minute, you know.
Yeah. Somebody else asked, it's a fairly obvious question. What do you think about Justin Barrett from the National Party getting banned from Twitter the other day?
Yeah, I don't know what he got banned for. I think he was posting quotes from Nixon tapes. You know, those tapes where Nixon expresses various politically incorrect views. But there's been a few bannings recently. I've posted worse stuff than Justin Barrett. I think it's pretty obvious it's because they don't want someone with the potential political clout of Barrett being an influencer there. So it's nothing new, you know.
Yeah, of course. They do it with everyone, including me, of course. But also Gemma Doherty and various others from Ireland. Okay, how do we get Irish and Scottish nationalists to realise that the English are not the enemy? Being Scottish myself, it's painful how much the nationalists don't get it.
Yeah, how do you convince them? I mean, I guess just seeing the reality of what's going on and seeing where this is going, because it really does put things in perspective, you know, when you look at the forecasts and when you look at the real world effects of what's going on, where multiculturalism is at its height, it really puts these squabbles between nations, not even just within Europe, but nations within the British Isles, it really puts them in perspective.
Yeah. I don't know what to say about this. I think that all we can do is keep pushing our ideas and our culture, our memes as well, and hope that they pick up on it. I mean, I think it really is time to put these old things away. I was getting really indignant about it the other day with a friend, IRL, not even on Millennial. I was having this discussion. I was saying, you know, we just have to get over this, these old things, because it's just not, you know, we are surrounded by people who are vastly different from us. And whatever differences we have, however meaningful they once were, we simply have to put them away at this stage, I think. All right. What does Keith think about the recent push by certain journalists and activists for mass migration to Japan?
That's an interesting one, because Japan was always held up by the alt-right and by nationalist movements as like sort of the uncookable country. And that's always the argument that's made, you know, well, Japan is an ethno state, and if Japan is entitled to have a country for Japanese people, why aren't we? And they, like, now they're even getting to Japan, like, it just shows, you know, nowhere is off limits. If they can take Ireland, that was, you know, up until 1992, homosexuality was illegal here, and, you know, less than 25 years later, we're the first country to vote in a referendum to legalize gay marriage, and overwhelmingly so. If they can do that, and if they can start, you know, Japan, this proud, noble culture, they can start to bring it in there. I mean, nowhere is off limits. And again, it gets back to this thing that how much can you do within your own nation? And, you know, this virus of global homo, eventually it's gonna infect everywhere unless it's cut out at the root.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I don't know how we should combat this, but we definitely need to be more intelligent about it than we have been hitherto. All right, not related to this guest, but can you have Borzoi on from TRS? Also, will Mikey not be on this year? Great shows this season. Thanks for doing this. Merry Christmas all. Thank you. I don't know if I enjoyed having Mikey Nock on last year as a sort of surprise guest. I think it was arranged at the last, literally at the last minute. But I think that what I can talk about with him or other people from TRS is limited by the current climate on YouTube, and so it's frustrating. But you know, all we can really do, most of what I did with Mike, you know, is just moan about the censorship situation, and that's not that interesting. Certainly not after you've done it once. I mean, people are going to start saying, "Oh, talk about something other than that. So, all right. Okay, I think that's all the super chats. What do you think about the left claiming that real Irish nationalists like Patrick Pearce are socialists and pro-gay?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's obviously absurd. I mean, the left always try and claim James Connolly because he was actually a Marxist, but at the same time, James Connolly is the man that said Ireland without its people means nothing to me. And I mean, you know, you just have to go back to reading these people. But that, you know, that's the thing. History isn't taught here now. They made history an optional subject in secondary schools. And again, this is a reflection of the capitalism we've adopted, because the reason they've done that is now we've all these optional subjects, and instead of having to learn history for a few years, you'll have the options and you can choose. You can learn Mandarin, you can learn IT. Those are two things that are being introduced as school subjects. I'm horrified by that idea, to be honest, that school now is just going to become an extension of this instrumental reason where, you know, from the age of 13 now, everything is going to be about making you the best possible worker ant for the international corporations. I'm horrified by that. It's just, I mean, a total. And Patrick Pearce himself, actually, his one of his most famous essays is called The Murder Machine. And he talked about the British education system and how it churned out these machines, and it killed the idealism in people. And he wanted to get back to what he conceived of as a more sort of Celtic rooted form of education that would sort of bring out the inner potential of the student. And you know, the education, everything Pearce said about the education system still applies, but it's gotten much worse. And you know, just getting back to that, I mean, you can't expect the people to defend themselves when they're completely unaware of their history and unaware of where they come from. And I'm sure that's a part of it as well.
Yeah, I agree with you that it's horrifying. I mean, it has to be said that I think a lot of people don't. Well, I mean, it's like a lot of things that do the. How much do the masses get from learning history when they're not that bright? I don't know, can they use it? But then it's not really about them understanding it or gathering information. It's more about it, having them imbibe a sense of their
story
own
story of ourselves. Yeah, because exactly. at the same time, any older Irish people you meet, you know, they all know who Connolly is, who Pearce is, who De Valera is. They all know, if nothing else, they know the story of the struggle for independence and the people involved and the ideals that were at the root of it. Not saying it doesn't matter how expansive that knowledge is. They have adopted that story, that mythology. It becomes more myth than history in a sense, and they've adopted that into their way of seeing the world, and that's what we're losing.
Yes, exactly. Somebody else makes the rather grim point that if they were like those people who do select history as a subject to learn, the history they'll be learning is anti-white and anti-Irish history.
Well, probably, yeah, that's going to come as well. Although it's hard looking at Irish, it's hard to spin it into a global homo narrative. I mean,
I don't know how they would do it, but I'm sure they'd find a way.
Yeah, I think it's easier just to take the Brave New World approach and just give them loads of junk food and loads of porn and stuff that no one really gives a shit about history or any of these things.
Mm. Here's one. I've got four more questions. Are the forces that fought for independence for so long still a force at all in Ireland, or are they owned by the EU and their money as well now?
Well, no, they've disappeared, but there are dissident IRA groups, and those IRA groups are completely at the behest of these forces. And if you want an example of that, there was a protest for free speech last week, a protest against hate speech laws that are coming in here, and across the street on the counter protest was a group that represents the new IRA, and they put a thing up on their website saying that their big fight now is against the rise in fascism in Ireland, and the IRA now, their real enemy is people like me, you know, rather than of all the subversive forces in Ireland now, the IRA, they call themselves the IRA, they're not, they have no connection to what was the original principles of the IRA. You know, they claim the big threat to Ireland now is people like me. It's It's absolutely absurd. Like,
it's so twisted and perverse, you can't believe it.
And there's actually, they said in that article, they were like, the republicanism is international. It's never been national. And it's like, well, I don't think Bobby Sands stared himself to death for internationalism, you know?
No, of course not.
I don't think you could starve yourself to death for an abstract principle like republican internationalism, you know? I think it's only something as rooted as nationalism that could drive someone to do something like that.
Absolutely. I've said this myself about values versus ethno-national, like civic national versus ethno-national. Who is going to kill or die for values? I don't.
And you see this throughout history. I mean, look at what happened when Germany invaded the Soviet Union. You know, Stalin started appealing to the Napoleonic invasion and the Great Patriotic War, and he went straight back to propaganda that was completely based around Russian nationalism and Russian patriotism, and really abandoned all the communist propaganda for the war years.
Yeah. Because they had to. In the end, it's not something that people are willing to suffer for. Values are ephemeral, and I could even say effeminate. They're not very real. They're not very interesting. They're not very exciting or engaging. I mean, they should be in theory, but in practice, I think they're just not. Okay. Will the next generation of nationalists create intellectuals at the caliber of Jared Taylor or Kevin MacDonald amongst an increasingly dumbed-down population and hyper-technological distractions?
Yeah, I think they will. Just the numbers game. I mean, Jared Taylor was saying that in a show with you, wasn't he? That when he started out, you know, it was such a small movement. You had to send off a letter to a P.O. box to get a publication once every 2 months. And I think just by the numbers now, there's so many people that have been sort of awakened that there's bound to be some gems in there. Also, the kind of person it attracts as well. That, as you know, as these things get more, as these areas of life get more separated and these become real niche interests, you're going to get more. You're going to have people that are seriously into this stuff and do have a serious intellect for it. I think we'll actually see we'll see some real high quality people coming out of it.
Yeah. In answer to my last reply, what I said about people wouldn't be prepared to die for values, someone said, what about free speech? People wouldn't kill or die for free speech. Is that ephemeral? A lot of people would say that they would die for freedom of speech, but then when it came to it, they'd think, fuck this, I don't care that much. Freedom of speech is precious and all that, but is it precious than your very life?
I think Jordan Peterson said he'd go on a hunger strike I think he said he'd go on a hunger strike if they arrested him the time of the thing with the forced into his pronouns.
I will die for pronouns.
Yeah. Yeah. Porrick Pierce said that he when he was a child, that he said in his letter before he died, he sent a letter to his mother and he said, when I was a child, I kneeled and prayed to God and begged him that one day I could have the privilege of dying for Ireland. But I can't imagine substituting that with another word like, dear God, please let me one day die for classical liberalism.
Well, we might hear it yet from a man in Sweden.
Let me die for classical liberalism. Let me die for classical liberalism for the Nigerians and Chinese that will come after my death.
Exactly. All right, well, let's leave it at that because this has been a very interesting and substantial stream. So I think people have enjoyed it. Lots of people singing your praises in the live chat. So maybe you should do this yourself on your own channel. You obviously enjoy answering questions and tackling these things. So,
yeah, that was a lot. That seemed like a lot of super chats.
It was a lot. It was a lot of them. A lot of people wanted your opinions on things. So, all right, that was 1,300 people live. That's very good. So, all right, I should get going because Frody is waiting.
Sorry for eating into your time, Frody, if you're listening.
Oh, I'm sure he's not too angry. All right. Okay, so I'll be back very soon with Frody. In the meantime, this was Keith Woods. I knew this would be a good one, and it certainly was. So thank you, Keith.
All right, thank you. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas, Keith, and I'll see the rest of you very shortly.